Hi, everyone. Welcome to FebRal, a culture podcast about all things infectious disease. We use consult questions to dive into ID, clinical reasoning, diagnostics, and antimicrobial management. I'm Sarah Dong, your host and a MedPeds ID doc. Today, I'm joined by several guests visiting from Florida. First up, we have Jacob Ricci. He is an MD-PhD student at University of Florida College of Medicine in Gainesville, Florida. He's in his fourth year of the program and second year of his PhD at the university. His research centers around sex and age differences in myocarditis, with a specific focus on cardiomacrophages in the lab of Dr. Caitlin Bruno.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me on, and I wanted to thank Dr. B for including me on this discussion.
Next up, we have Dr. Akansha Alok. She is an infectious diseases and global medicine fellow at the University of Florida. Originally from India, she completed her medical school at Kasturba Medical College in Manipal, India, and her residency at the University of Central Florida / HCA Florida North Florida Hospital.
Hey, everyone. This is Akansha. So glad to be here. And thank you, Dr. Beatty, for including us.
And lastly, we are joined by Dr. Norman Beatty. He is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Global Medicine at the University of Florida College of Medicine. He serves as an associate hospital epidemiologist at UF Health Shands Hospital in Gainesville.
Hey, everybody. This Norm Beatty here. Always pumped to talk about Chagas.
All right. As everyone's favorite cultured podcast, I would love to hear about a little piece of culture, you know, just something that brings you happiness.
Sure. I think being in Gainesville, there's a music scene that is somewhat unique to Florida, and I really enjoy getting out of the lab and being able to find some small shows in Gainesville to go to.
I actually love traveling and experiencing new things. In fact, last weekend, I went camping in a camper van, like 3 miles inside a national forest, so that was pretty cool. You know, being close to nature was pretty incredible.
That's fun. Me, I am a runner. I'm on the road. I'm wondering if med students are looking to kind of plow me over sometimes, but I am prepping for another marathon. So if I'm not in the hospital or in clinic doing lab stuff, I'm on the road running.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, as everyone is going to be able to guess by now, we're going to talk a little bit about Chagas today, but I will hand it over to Jake.
Thanks. So our first case, a gentleman in his 70s presents to the hospital with several episodes of feeling faint and numbness in his face. He has a past medical history of hypertension and controlled insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus. In the ED, he is noted to have sinus bradycardia into the 40s with right bundle branch block and frequent PVCs. Given the report of numbness in his face, he has a CTA head for stroke alert, which was negative. His initial high-sensitivity troponin I was mildly elevated, and BNP 253, which was also mildly elevated. It was unclear if the ECG changes were new, and with some cardiac markers elevated, he undergoes a left heart catheterization, which does not show any evidence of ischemic disease. He is admitted to the inpatient cardiovascular unit for management for symptomatic bradycardia. He is monitored overnight on telemetry with some readings showing heart rate dipping into the 30s, but intermittently in the 40s. Transthoracic echocardiography is done that morning, revealing mildly reduced left ventricular systolic function with an estimated LVEF of 45% to 49% and basal to mid inferior hypokinesis. The patient is a retired agricultural worker from North Florida. He's born in Mexico and lived in rural settings on a farm until his 20s during his childhood and young adult years. He has been living in the United States for more than 40 years, but he frequently travels back to visit family in Mexico. The heart failure team called a consult for investigation with concerns of Chagas heart disease.
So, Akansha, Dr. Beatty here. What is Chagas disease? How is this transmitted? Help everybody know what we're going to be looking for.
Sure. So, Chagas disease is due to an infection from Trypanosoma cruzi, which is a kinetoplastid protozoan. It is transmitted by several known mechanisms. One of them is a vector-borne through the triatomene bug, which is more commonly known as the kissing bug. Their feces can contain the parasite and can contaminate the skin or the environment and incidentally be introduced to mucous membrane or a breach in the skin or even be ingested accidentally. Another mechanism is oral transmission risk from contaminated food or drinks containing the parasite. Most commonly, this happens through certain fruit juices, such as acai berries, guava, or even palm wine that is unpasteurized. Some vectors are found in ecosystems where the bug or the feces can contaminate the juice preparation process, and that's how the transmission occurs. It can also be transmitted congenitally from chronically infected mother to the fetus. Anywhere from 1 to 10% of mothers living with untreated Chagas disease are known to transmit to the fetus in utero. Another way is donor-derived from organ transplantation if a donor is chronically infected with Chagas disease. Blood transfusion is also another method for transmission, especially in certain regions of the world where the blood donation services are not screening for chronic Chagas disease. In the United States, this practice was started around 2007. Laboratory accidents can be another source among those who acquire the disease in a laboratory setting.
So given this case, which we saw in the hospital recently, what are our next steps in assessing for Chagas disease? Heart failure team has called us. They're well attuned to Chagas at this point. And what are some risk factors we're seeing in this patient? So I think most importantly, when we are considering Chagas disease on our differential diagnosis, we really want to think about their exposure risks. We want to think about the endemic regions of the Americas where they have lived or have been born. Were they living in a rural setting in their lifetime? Certain farming communities, the insects are prevalent. Certain scenarios where their housing would allow for the this vector to either invade or colonize the home structure. For example, some adobe structures, thatched roofing, but also just housing that's porous to the environment. We really kind of get into the weeds on how this house was built. Is it above the ground? Is it sitting on stilts? Because there are many vectors. There's over 150 known species of Triadomene insects in the Americas. Each one of them has their own unique kind of ecosystem that they live in. So, for example, in the desert southwest, people live on the edge of a cliff, literally, and their house is sitting above stilts. And underneath that house, you'll find animals that are residing under the house, and the insects will crawl up through the floorboards. So, we really want to understand the housing structure of our patient throughout their lifetime, even here in the United States. And we also want to talk about Chagas disease. I mean, I have found in my conversations with many people that they are aware of this disease. Certain parts of the world, there is education occurring even in elementary school or primary school. People are taught about Chagas. In Brazil and Argentina, this is very common in elementary school level of education. And then they come and they're here in the United States, they're visiting, or they live here now, and they understand this disease, they remember it. So we talk about the disease. We also talk about the bugs. I mean, the bugs are fun to talk about. I pull up a picture, I'm in the hospital, there's a computer there, I'm like, hold on, let me show you what a kissing bug looks like. I think about the region where they're from or where they've been, and I pull up the most common vector there. Sometimes it's Triatoma dimidiata, Rhodanis prolixis. There's a number of species that are more common, but we'll pull it up and we'll say, hey, do you remember this bug? Do you remember the barbeiro? That is how we call it in Brazil, or the vinchuca in Bolivia and certain parts of that region of South America. So we try to talk about the insect through just understanding how it is described in that culture. And from there, we talk about being bitten by this bug, finding it in your home. Have you ever seen this in your home? Have you ever seen this at work? Some folks live and work in the same area, and they may have had exposure in that way. And then, do we have any family members with Chagas disease? When we talk about Chagas with families, they start to remember their mother passing away early from a cardiac arrest, or grandma had an enlarged heart and she passed away. And so I have found that when we start talking some details about Chagas disease, people remember. And that tells us that this individual may be at a heightened risk through their exposures in their lifetime. And then lastly, we have concerns in the United States that Chagas is being transmitted regularly in certain areas. And we want to understand where they have lived here in the United States. What was their housing situation in childhood? Do they have dogs or cats that sleep in their house? Have they found the insect here? Is there a concern for the insects in the United States transmitting this in a region like Texas. So there are certain regions that we're worried about right now. And we really just want to recognize that good history taking, like all of us ID docs, this is what we do. It just really helps us hone in. Is this person at risk for Chagas? So looking at our patient, it's pretty obvious. He's at risk. I love when the heart failure team calls. I'm like, well, you're calling because you know this person's at risk. Let me help you assess this patient. Let's get some tests done. And so what are we looking to do? We're looking to send off basically serologic assays. These assays are readily available now. We can order these at multiple different commercial labs. These assays are FDA approved. We have four of them right now. They're FDA approved. And what I like to do is at least send two off, but if I can, send more, because all these assays have different sensitivities or specificities based off of where this parasite was derived from. And we can talk about that a little bit later, but based off this clinical presentation, we should send off some ELISA-based assays, as well as we have a lab that's offering certain assays, the Trypanosoma Excretory Secretory Antigen Test, the TISA Immunoblot. There's another test called the Multicruzi available now. And so we sent all of those tests off on our patient. And as you can tell, there is some concerns for cardiac involvement. So we sent those assays off. And let's get back to our case, Jake.
Sure. So this gentleman lived in a region of Mexico in his childhood where triads means were known, and some population studies revealed a prevalence of 1% to 3% of the population. Patient, he remembered the chinche insects when shown a picture of Triatoma patelopennis, which is the known vector in that region. He remembers the insects both in his home and being bitten as well. So we recommended sending anti-T-cruzi IgG assays to several reference labs, and rapid lateral flow assay was done as well.
Pause there, Jake. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I love using these rapid tests. We have one that's FDA approved in the United States, and it is easy to use. It is easy to use. Chagas disease is easy to diagnose as well in most situations. We just need to think about it and send the tests off. Sorry, keep going. I'm getting excited.
No, you're good. So while waiting on the results of these serological assays, we decided to get a cardiac MRI, and we also requested an electrophysiology consult.
All right, Akanksha. Cardiac MRI. Let's talk about cardiac MRI because we know so much about this now and it's growing in its abilities for helping us with Chagas heart disease.
Yeah. Cardiac MRI actually helps us detect myocardial fibrosis, which is a key finding in Chagas disease. We were actually very fortunate to have access to cardiac MRI in our facility. So we were able to get this for this patient. We also reviewed an interesting article, which was published in the Journal of American College of Cardiology, which was a systematic review and a meta-analysis on diagnosing myocardial fibrosis by cardiac MRI and its outcomes in Chagas disease. This article showed how cardiac MRI, especially with late gadolinium enhancement, can detect myocardial fibrosis even in indeterminate forms of Chagas disease, where EKG and echo results are completely normal. Cardiac MRI also gives us the extent and pattern of the myocardial fibrosis, which can give us a clue on the prognosis of the disease. It can help us assess for myocardial fibrosis and inflammation with a specific pattern that is consistent with Chagas heart disease. It can also reveal structural abnormalities, such as apical aneurysms, which are consistent with Chagas disease.
Okay, great overview. So what did we find?
So in this patient, the cardiac MRI results revealed extensive mid-myocardial late gadolinium enhancement involving most of the anteroseptum, inferoseptum, apical septum with associated areas of elevated T1 and largely normal T2 time. These findings were basically suggestive of infiltrative cardiomyopathy.
So we have a pattern consistent with chagastic cardiomyopathy, and we have some serologic tests coming back. What did we find?
So, as mentioned earlier, Trypanosoma cruzi IgG was sent for this patient. That was negative, actually. However, we sent further serological tests, such as the trypomastigot excreted secreted antigen, or the TESA immunoblot. And this is a confirmatory serological test for Chagas, and that was positive for our patient. And also the multi-cruzi assay and the rapid lateral flow assay were also positive.
oh my gosh, what do we do with this? Is this uncommon? This is the fun of Chagas disease. We have discordant findings. We have a negative test. And that negative test was a whole lysate preparation of T. cruzi antigens. And he did have some detection, but it wasn't enough to meet the criteria for positivity. So why does this happen? And why is it important to try to send off at least two tests to help us understand if a person's at risk? Well, it's all about the parasite and the humans. You know, the parasite has unique strains. There's at least six that we know. We call them DTUs, discrete typing units, 1 through 6. And each region actually has its own different haplotypes that may infect humans and may be more pathogenic than others. That's the ongoing research of T. cruzi. But we do know that the parasite expresses at various levels different antigens that we have developed these antibodies to. We also see that certain populations are just not responding like we would like them to these antigens. And, you know, this is population genetics that we're, you know, also in the research phase. But in the moment, we need to find people with Chagas and we need to consider the differential. And so that is why most of the time when I have a patient who has high risk for Chagas disease, especially clinically, it's important to try to send off as many tests as possible and then sort out the results of those tests. So with having three tests that are rather specific for Chagas disease and one that was negative with his clinical scenario and epidemiologic risk, this is a confirmatory case of Chagas cardiomyopathy. So what do we do now? What's next for our patient? And sitting down and having a conversation with our electrophysiology team, getting a consult with them, as well as talking about ICD placement for primary prevention. You know, what is the feared complication of Chagasic cardiomyopathy or even Chagas heart disease? And it is sudden cardiac death. We do know that this is one of the most common causes of just death amongst people with cardiac disease in certain regions of Latin America. And we do see that even in a person who may have mild or subtle signs and symptoms of cardiac involvement, they can have a fatal malignant arrhythmia, as we would say, and they will pass away. Anyone who focuses on Chagas has cases that really resonate with them. And that is something that, you know, each time I encounter a case where a person has a sudden cardiac arrest and it's from Chagas, it really just brings home how devastating and how important it is to find these cases earlier and do our best to prevent that moment from happening. So we discussed putting an ICD in. We also did some studies to see how dangerous his bradycardia was, and the electrophysiology team felt he did not need a pacemaker this time, but we talked about primary prevention with an ICD, and that was placed. And he's going to see me in clinic next week, and we're going to talk about the next phases of his care. But when we look at Chagas heart disease and cardiomyopathy, we have different stages A, B, C, and D. And in this case, he would be considered stage C. And at stage C, we typically do not recommend antiparasitic therapy. And we are giving him goal-directed medical treatment, GDMT. It just rolls right off the tongue nowadays and then on rounds. We're also thinking about prime prevention of sudden cardiac death and also just monitoring for the progression of heart failure. If he was a little bit younger, he'd likely receive consultation for heart transplant, which I think is really exciting in the world of Chagas heart disease, especially for younger folks. And they do well when they receive a transplant, and we can treat through the reactivation. I don't think today we'll focus on Chagas and transplant, but we really want to just recognize that younger patients with cardiomyopathies from Chagas, we should be thinking about prepping them for transplantation and bridge to therapy and all the things we do with heart transplant. So, and really last thing I'll mention is, you know, once I diagnose a person with Chagas disease, we really do bring the whole family together and we start talking about screening all the immediate family members because they have that same lived experience. They've been in the same regions. They may have had the same exposure to the vector or oral transmission. So, you know, we would sometimes find another family member with Chagas disease and they never knew it. So we really want to bring the family in, talk about disease, get folks screened, and make Chagas disease just a conversation on rounds and in our hospitals, and really just recognize that this is a disease we need to tackle. Okay, sorry, I'm rambling now. Okay, let's keep going. Jay, case two.
All right. For our second case, we have a healthy woman in her early 40s who presented to the clinic after receiving a letter in the mail that says she has a positive Chagas test. She is otherwise healthy and very active in her photography profession. She decided to donate blood after leaving the gym one day and thought nothing of it. But several weeks later, she received a letter in the mail from the blood service about these results.
Okay, I chose this case because it's a very common scenario, especially for ID doc. Show up in the clinic, you look on your panel, and it might say Chagas disease. You're like, what in the world? And then you go and you talk to your patient, and they receive this letter in the mail. Why did they receive this? What's going on? Akanksha, tell us more about what has happened here.
Yeah, so, you know, these cases are very interesting. And again, it goes down to a good history taking, like Dr. BT was mentioning earlier. So we need to ask a lot of questions in these cases, such as country of birth, any recent history of traveling, or even traveling in childhood or young adult years in endemic areas, especially in rural regions. And how much was the duration of stay in those areas? Any recreational activities, history of living on a farm, or any direct exposure to the triatomine or kissing bug. Even family history is important, such as family history of Chagas or cardiac diseases or GI diseases. Even history of organ transplant or history of receiving blood products in the past. Any exposure to wildlife or eating wildlife. Exposure to raw foods or even fruit juices is important to ask. Other than that, we should also look for clinical evidence of any chronic Chagas disease. So we would ask questions like any generalized symptoms such as fever, weight loss, fatigue, any cardiac symptoms like chest pain, palpitations, dyspnea, or any history of syncope or arrhythmias, or even GI symptoms such as dysphagia, regurgitation, severe constipation, or abdominal distension.
That's awesome. And does this patient have Chagas disease?
So blood donation screening tests are highly sensitive, but they're not very specific. Diagnosis of Chagas disease actually requires two different serological tests using different antigens or methods. So at this point, we cannot say that this patient has Chagas disease, as we should never diagnose Chagas with just one single serological test.
Oh, that is a perfect answer. And also very important, because should we give this individual antiparasitic medicine right now?
No, we shouldn't treat this patient for Chagas disease until the disease is confirmed with two different serological tests.
That is the perfect answer as well, because we do see this sometimes. Folks are donating blood. They get this letter in the mail. They have had some exposure risk in the past, and or, you know, our tests are so sensitive that it may be a false positive. The exact false positive rate for our blood donor servicer screening assays are really unknown at this point, but it is not a trivial false positive rate. On the flip side, I have had plenty of patients who did come in with this letter. They did have some risks, and we did confirm they had Chagas disease and they didn't know about it. And even some folks who, after a good history taking, we noticed that they have subtle signs of palpitations, and that we have worked up and we have found that they do have evidence of Chagas heart disease. So we really want to recognize what these tests do. They help our blood bank to stay safe from transmission of Chagas disease in someone chronically infected. But also, it is really our only modality right now for screening populations just randomly who donate blood, obviously. And they will come in possibly with just indeterminate phase of chronic Chagas. They don't know that they have this disease, but they maybe had congenital transmission or acquired this in childhood or acquired this throughout their life. And now we need to recognize that and do more testing and send off more FDA-approved tests. So that way we can have a firm diagnosis. Because, you know, having a diagnosis of Chagas disease is a lifelong diagnosis. It's something that will stay with you, something we need to continue to monitor over time. We need to consider a treatment, and we really want to ensure that we have the right diagnosis here. And so we should not give a person antiparasitic medicines until we understand that they have true confirmation of this disease. And so again, getting back to like access to testing, which I think is really gray here in the United States at this time, we have access to tests, you know, Quest, LabCorp, ARUP, Mayo Clinic. You know, I don't endorse any one laboratory. I really, you know, just want to recognize that we have commercial labs that are utilizing assays that have had rigorous clinical trials on their assays. And they, you know, there's some studies showing that they're performing well here in the United States. And we also have newer labs coming. We have Caffera Diagnostics, which I've been using regularly. And they also offer some other assays like the TISA Immunoblot and the Multicruzi tests. And so we have access to tests, folks, and we want to get people screened. And, you know, certain situations we may consider, you know, especially for somebody who has high risk for exposure to the bug, or a mother who has known to be living with chronic Chagas disease, and we want to screen the children. We want to recognize those special populations, recognize that sometimes people may have negative tests, but the risks are so high. And that's when we really want to start talking to experts about how we can investigate this, you know, especially for those we're preparing for immunosuppression, we're preparing for a transplant, because, you know, if that parasite is still in that person's body and we give them immunosuppression, they could have reactivation. And we do see that. So sometimes our tests are negative, just like any infectious disease test. Like I remind people, there's no tests that are 100% sensitive nor specific. So it gets us ID folks just thinking like we love to do, but recognize that in high risk scenarios, we really want to think intently about tests that may be negative, but truly they do have Chagas disease chronically. All right, Jake, back to our case here.
All right. Upon further history, the patient was found to be born in Bolivia outside of Santa Cruz in a rural setting. She remembers the vinchucha in the home, and she also frequently visits family who still lives in her childhood home. She denies any symptoms. The rapid lateral flow assay is positive in clinic, and additional serological assays are positive. So what stage of chronic Chagas does this patient have?
Kanksha, what do you think?
So she most likely has indeterminate chronic Chagas disease. This is when a person has serological evidence of Chagas disease but does not have any evidence of organ involvement. Determinant chronic Chagas disease is when we have evidence of organ damage or involvement. It could be cardiovascular, esophageal, colonic, or any other organ system such as the central nervous system as well.
Yeah, so really important to recognize indeterminate phases of what we call chronic Chagas disease. And just like Akanksha mentioned, indeterminate phase is where, you know, we have serologic evidence that T. cruzi has entered a human's body. We have serologic tests that are positive. They've been in an endemic area. And we've done testing to see if we have any involvement, and clinically and with the testing, we're not finding any involvement. You know, we do know that 30-40% of people who've been exposed to the parasite do not ever mount any type of disease from it. We have another smaller group that's around 30% who actually end up with chronic determinant phase Chagas disease, which is what we're worried about. We're worried about that chronic progression of cardiovascular involvement or esophageal involvement, colonic involvement. You know, these are the three areas we see the most. That's about 30% of this group. And then the other kind of 30% is this indeterminate phase, really, where we don't know if they'll ever develop any disease from it. And we really want to monitor them over time and consider therapies in all of these groups based off of how much involvement they may have in their determinate phase, and also look at those in indeterminate phase. So who should be treated for Chagas disease? That's always a very common question for me. And also, you know, I am a believer in just looking at how long someone has potentially been infected with this and going over risks and benefits of our antiparasitic medicines, because we really don't understand as much as we want right now about the impact of antiparasitic medicine. But I do know that children should be treated. Any child should be treated. Any woman of childbearing age, to help mitigate the risks of congenital transmission. And any person with acute phase Chagas, you know, that is where we do know that we can cure a person from that chronic infection. When a person is living with indeterminate chronic Chagas disease and they're in their 30s and 40s, you know, they will likely do well with a course of benznidazole or nifurtimox. And when we're starting to get into the fifth, sixth decade of life, we're really looking at, well, how long have you been exposed? You know, I have a couple of patients we've had this conversation with. The last time they were really in an endemic area was 50 years ago. Will they develop chronic Chagas disease manifestations? Probably not. They're probably in that group where they're not impacted by this disease. Their immune system was able to destroy that parasite when it entered the body and it didn't cause a chronic infection. And we go over risks and benefits. And some folks have told me, well, I don't think I'm going to get this and I don't want to go through the side effects of some of these medications. So we're just going to continue to monitor. And that's reasonable if a person has been decades away from an exposure. But what I have also found is that people are in and out of endemic regions, visiting family, going back to the farm, having exposures possibly that we just don't understand. So I really try to get into the weeds here on the exposure because I do believe that, you know, the studies are showing that we can either halt the progression of a chronic infection manifestations, or even possibly cure a person from developing, you know, the feared complications of Chagas heart disease. So, you know, we really have a good conversation about risks and benefits and what we see in business on nifurtimox medications. The one group we do know we won't treat typically is when folks are in that kind of end stage involvement, especially with the heart. You know, when we get into that stage C and D, we're really looking at how do we optimize a goal-directed medical treatment, as well as primary prevention for sudden cardiac death and, you know, for colonic involvement. I have a patient right now who has a megacolon that needs to be surgically resected because, you know, it has been going on for several decades and antiparasitic is not going to prevent that chronic manifestation of that colon. So really the antiparasitic medications when we're in the end stages of disease really have not shown any benefit. But at this point, a lot of our patients, having an open conversation and looking at the risks and benefits is important. One thing I do recommend is any person who has serologic evidence of infection, we're really diving into that complete review of systems, like Akanksha mentioned, a good physical exam, and also getting some baseline labs, always getting an ECG. I do the ECG in the clinic. I've read thousands of ECGs at this point, and I feel comfortable reading them. But also just the subtle findings on ECG can be the first evidence of involvement. Like, for example, it's just a first degree heart block popping up and the patient didn't know about it. Things like that, or a left anterior fascicular block. I mean, that shouldn't be there. And it could be involved. It could be evidence of Chagas heart disease. Having a 2D echo, a transthoracic echo with contrast, you know, that can help us. We can see an apical aneurysm sometimes on a TTE, but also we can look for any wall abnormalities. We can look at, HEF-MREF is a new term I'm learning about now, mildly reduced ejection fraction. I love the terms in cardiology, but we're looking for how's the pump squeezing, things like that. And if you have access to a cardiac MRI, you know, all of my patients who are in this indeterminate phase workup, if we can acquire access to a cardiac MRI, we're getting it. Because I think the data is showing that this is the most sensitive radiologic assay that we have, looking for involvement of this process in the heart, even in a person who's clinically asymptomatic. So I am seeing in the literature and in my own practice, cardiac MRI being useful. But I do recognize in certain populations, we may not have access to it. So, you know, hopefully over time we will. And we'll have programs to help people to have access to these things. But I think that's a very important concept as well. And then just also lastly, we're looking at the esophagus. You know, esophageal Chagas disease is there. It is in our communities. I have two patients right now with esophageal disease. It can start off with a conversation on dysphagia, difficulties with swallowing certain foods. And that's the first evidence of esophageal dysmotility disorder. And I have chatted with my GI folks about this and helping our team understand what Chagas esophageal involvement looks like, and getting the esophageal manometry will be very useful in that diagnosis. And as well as just plain X-ray of the abdomen. You know, we can start seeing colonic distension and, you know, with colonic involvement, it's about the history taking of constipation. And what I have found is, a lot of people are constipated. I get it. I mean, it happens to everybody, but colonic Chagas is a progression and it is stable over time. And it's, you know, going 3, 4, 5 days without a bowel movement. And then it's going a week without a bowel movement. And now the person has changed their diet inadvertently because they recognize this. And so that is the story of colonic jaundice. It's just very slow progression of constipation and distension of the abdomen because the colon is expanding. So getting a good history into talking about that with our patients is an essential element to looking into this. So what about antiparasitics here? Well, what we know is we have access to benznidazole and nifurtimox here in the United States. They're both FDA approved. Benznidazole is approved for children less than 12 and nifurtimox 18 and younger. But we use a lot of these two medications off-label for treating our patients in this indeterminate phase and even some with early signs of Chagas heart disease. And I focus on the PAHO and WHO guidelines as well as some really great guidelines from Brazil in 2023, which we can put a link into the chat about that. But these guidelines are fantastic. They kind of break everything down for people at risk for cardiac involvement, how to manage that. Benznidazole side effects, they are notable and important to recognize. Anywhere from 30% or more will end up developing some sort of cutaneous involvement of a rash, allergic reaction. They can be rather severe. We can have a person develop DRESS or develop Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And in the clinic, we really talk about, you know, the manifestations of benznidazole. Most people, when they're taking the medicine, feel something. They feel tired. They notice right away that they're just fatigued and tired. And, you know, I'm talking about lifestyle. I'm talking about the job that they may have. You know, how can we ensure that they can complete this course? You know, if we look at some of the studies that have been done, you know, sometimes greater than 50% of the cohort did not complete kind of that 60-day treatment that we're looking for. And so, you know, we really want to bring that to light to our patients, just like we do it with a lot of other antimicrobials. Another thing we look at is we look at LFTs, transaminitis can occur. I'm keeping track of just the bone marrow, looking at CBCs, DEF, just trying to make sure no cytopenias develop. And within the first 3 to 5 days, once a person has started benznidazole, again, those baseline labs are important so that we can look at changes from those baseline labs. I like using CRPs in the beginning, because if a CRP is negative, and then we start benznidazole, and we start seeing the CRP creeping up to positive and going up even higher, it may inform us that an allergic reaction is coming. A lot of these allergic reactions develop within a kind of a 7 to 10 day window, and it's pretty clockwork. And all of a sudden, they call and they've got a rash in their body. And so what do you do? Well, a lot of times we are trying to treat with low doses of prednisone. And some practice of mine is reducing benznidazole slightly and then continuing prednisone, starting maybe at 20 milligrams and seeing if that will help this allergic reaction and trying to get back up to the recommended dose. You know, it's a case-by-case scenario, essentially, with each patient. But just recognizing we're trying to get to that 60 days just for now. That's what's been recommended. But trying to help this person get as much benznidazole in their body as possible with the right dose. What is the dose of benznidazole? There's an ongoing conversation about that. But what we have found, my practice, you know, we stick to the 300 milligrams a day max dose, and we divide that into two, possibly three doses. Most of the time, two doses, so 150 twice a day. And, you know, that has shown to reduce the side effects as well as, from what we know, been efficacious against the parasite. Now, nifurtimox is typically a second-line agent when a person cannot tolerate benznidazole and has its own side effect profile. A lot of these side effects are central nervous system related. You know, we can have patients who develop even like a psychosis or develop headache disorder. Clearly, remember a patient we were using nifurtimox on, and the headache just was almost at the migraine level 24/7, and we had to stop after 3 days. And within a couple of days, the headaches were gone. So, you know, each one of these, both these medications, the side effect profiles are important to review as well as just discuss with our patients so that way they understand when they start taking this medicine, side effects are possible, if not probable. But the importance of this treatment is also something we discuss because we really, at this point, we attempt a one-time treatment, but we usually do not attempt more than one treatment course, either with benzenazole or nifurtimox. And so we really want to just really assess whether or not we can get this treatment to that full course. And as we study Chagas, as we look at these courses, we are finding that possibly shorter courses are just as efficacious. And so more of that research will be coming out in the near future. But, you know, right now, an antiparasitic course is reasonable, again, for any child, a woman of childbearing age, any acute Chagas, any individual kind of in this indeterminate phase in their 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s. And then when we start to get to the sixth decade of life, we're having risk benefits. We're looking at how long they've been, you know, possibly infected and where then they would have gotten infected. And I'm an advocate for considering therapy at that point. And who we do not treat is folks with end-stage Chagas disease, you know, that stage CD cardiomyopathy, you know, heavily involved colonic disease or esophageal disease. We're now trying to manage the symptoms moving forward. So what's the future of Chagas disease? You know, I'm a hopeful guy. And also, I'm so happy that we have just an ongoing growing awareness of Chagas disease here in the United States. And I just want to stress that Chagas disease is a disease in the Americas. It's a disease that's found here in North, Central, and South America. We have vectors in these regions. And in the United States, the majority of the southern portion of the United States has the kissing bug vectors that have the same parasite that we see in Mexico, Central, and South America. Some of the work we're doing here in Florida, Jake is an MD, PhD student, and he's been in the lab growing Trypanosoma cruzi from Florida, and we've called this the T. cruzi Gainesville strain. How's that been, Jake? How exciting is it to see T. cruzi growing in a media?
It's been awesome. I think you can assume that from my bio with a background in medical physics, I didn't have much cell culture experience. And so when you approached me with this to grow some of these parasites, it was going to be a learning experience, but I'm very happy that you and your collaborators, as well as the collaborators in the Bruno lab have supported me so much through this. And yeah, it's been really cool kind of taking a look through the microscope and seeing the parasites kind of moving around in there and trying to isolate everything and see what's going on.
Yeah, we're now going to be injecting this parasite into mouse models here in our lab to see how pathogenic even the T. cruzi Gainesville strain is. But you know, that all started from looking at bugs here in Florida and just finding this parasite and about 30% of them and thinking, wow, this is right here in the state of Florida. And I think the more we are looking around the United States for T. cruzi infection and possible transmission routes, the more we're finding. And really just having an open conversation about the dogma of Chagas disease, you know, do we understand these cycles as well as we think we do? And, you know, is there something we're missing? Not only here in the United States, but other regions of the Americas, you know, the epidemiology of Chagas is changing. You know, some of the initiatives that have taken place throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s have really helped decrease the burden of Chagas disease in certain communities and other public health initiatives in certain regions like Argentina, Brazil, Colombia. They've been able to tackle Chagas. They've been able to show certain communities now have significant decrease in Chagas disease, if not like certain vectors, like the Rhodnius prolixus insect is not found in certain regions anymore because of vector control programs. But on the flip side, we are seeing that certain areas are now showing increased evidence of Chagas disease, especially in regions of non-endemicity, like in Europe, where folks have immigrated to places like Spain. You know, we're seeing people living with chronic Chagas disease. But the public health infrastructure, I think, is important for Chagas. You know, it does impact a lot of people who are marginalized or who are also living with low resources. And I look forward to being a part of that conversation in the United States for helping just recognize the importance of this being a disease that is reportable in all 50 states, and also kind of building an infrastructure around linkage to care and the testing that is needed. Because what I have seen is once a person is diagnosed with Chagas disease, things do change. We do make it happen. We find a way to get the care that they need. We find a way to get them therapies. We find a way to treat the whole or test the whole family, and also just the conversations around Chagas change, you know, and we find that people are more accepting that this is a disease that is right under our noses in certain situations. You know, I want to go back to that case with, that Jake was describing where the patient came in with the letter and, you know, she had the rapid test done in the clinic with me. And we looked down at the test and we could see the clear lines that were showing positivity. And she looked at me and she was visibly shaken. There was an emotional connection to that test in the moment because it told us that, well, this is probably true. This is probably Chagas disease. And she kind of shared with me her feelings about the disease because she grew up in Bolivia and she had people in her community who have died from Chagas disease. And so she, you know, it changed her a little bit. And also she felt empowerment to get the testing done that we needed to get done and to undergo a therapy and to get her whole family tested, her children tested, her husband tested. You know, it's just a reminder that I think about Chagas and I think about HIV as well. So I'm talking to the right group here. We are passionate about our patients, right? And there's a lot of passionate HIV providers listening right now. And I have an HIV clinic too, but I look at Chagas in a very similar light. You know, we recognize that this disease is impactful not only for a patient, but also everyone around them. We have the tools necessary to help folks walk alongside them with this disease. And that's why I'm here today. I'm so excited to be here on the Febrile podcast. It's a great way to spread awareness about infectious diseases and kind of help us move along the trajectory of Chagas disease. So I'm glad that we could be here today.
Yeah, you guys, this was incredible. Any closing thoughts?
I'd like Jake and Akanksha maybe to mention something, you know, impactful, because Jake, you're a scientist, right? You're going to be tackling infectious diseases, but maybe something that is impactful for you as you have studied now TKRSE in the lab a little bit. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, what you said where, you know, it's kind of been under our noses and we're now sort of realizing the importance of, you know, looking for it in terms of testing and patients that, you know, come in with the letters that, you know, similar to the case that we discussed. I think there's a lot of very interesting opportunities in the future in terms of research with in Chagas disease specifically. Like you were mentioning, Dr. Beatty, it's, you know, we're able to grow it in our lab and, you know, hopefully in the near future, we can start getting it into our mouse models. I know like the infrastructure at UF has the ability to ultrasound, do echoes on these mice, do cardiac MR on these mice. And so I think there's a very, very big opportunity to make some pretty significant advances in our understanding of this disease, as well as like potential strain differences between, you know, the strain that you've isolated in Gainesville versus some of the other more common strains that you see in the endemic regions.
You know, from the clinical side of things, Chagas is still kind of a rare disease, right? So I was actually feeling very lucky and fortunate that I was able to see a case of Chagas disease during my training. And it was pretty impactful for me to like even go see the patient that we talked about, the first patient. Like, he seemed like the most normal person in a, like, hospitalized. And once you first see him, you wouldn't even know why he's in the hospital. He was hemodynamically stable, looking very benign. And then the deeper we talked about, you know, his history and the clues that we gathered, and we were kind of coming to the conclusion that, oh, he might actually have Chagas. Just knowing about it kind of, you know, brought that thought in our mind. So I think it's very important to spread awareness about Chagas, because these patients can just be walking around like me and you, and we wouldn't know that they have these particular risk factors, and that could lead to a diagnosis of Chagas disease. So I think that was very impactful for me from the clinical side of things.
Oh, wow. Thanks for your comments, guys. I'm glad that you could be a part of this with me. And Akanksha, I'm glad you could see that patient. And I think your point is just amazing. We, need to be putting Chagas on our differential, you know, especially in people who have these risk factors. And we have advancements in detection and therapies and management that are ongoing. And, you know, before we go, I just want to mention that, you know, we need to destigmatize this disease. We need to just start thinking about it as and just another infectious process that we have in our communities and demystify it and recognize we have all the tools we need to care for these folks. And I look forward to being a part of that conversation with my colleagues around the United States and around the world. I'm just happy to be a part of it. And also, I'm hopeful that we'll just continue to make strides in the right direction. So really great that we could have this conversation today. And you know, if you ever have a case that you have questions about, feel free to reach out to me. I talk to folks from all over the United States about Chagas disease. But Sarah, this was amazing. I love your podcast and the abilities that we can have these conversations about infectious diseases. It's the best field of medicine. I tell the med students all the time, it's the best field of medicine. You'll never have a dull moment and you can always make an impact no matter where you're practicing.
That's the perfect conclusion.
Thank you so much to our guests today, Jake, Akansha, and Norm. Don't forget to check out the website, febrilepodcast.com, where you can find the consult notes, which are written supplements to the episodes with links to references, our library of ID infographics, and a link to our merch store. Febrile is produced with support from the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Please reach out if you have any suggestions for future shows or want to be more involved with Febrile. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you next time.